grateful to Jock Robertson and grateful to you for coming. I hope that you don't feel that there is something unfair about the fact that I shall be doing all the talking at this particular session, but I do hope that we may have the opportunity of engaging in discussion later on, and this seemed to be the best way to do it. And I would like very much to feel, too, that if there are some provocative things that I say, things that you so thoroughly disagree with, you would feel free to come and talk either to myself or to other people who hold the Christian faith afterwards. And I think I'm going to have the chance of being available in a room in DUC during the afternoons, so that there, too, you will have the opportunity of coming and talking then. Perhaps I might begin this evening with a word or two about the purpose of these evening addresses, and more particularly about the general approach that I'm going to suggest we might take as we try to discover what the Christian faith is all about. It seems to me that the reason that so many otherwise thoughtful people have rejected or dismissed the Christian faith is quite simply that they've never taken the trouble seriously to inquire exactly what it is that Christianity is about and what the Christian faith has to say. I would suggest to you that the issues with which the Christian faith deals are so important for every single man and woman about life, about the great issues that we are facing together day by day, that it's incumbent upon every thoughtful person to come to some kind of conclusion about the validity of historic Christianity. And as I see it, the purpose of my being here on these evenings is to help you to discharge this responsibility. And my task will therefore, as I understand it, be simply to try to set before you as clearly and as straightforwardly as I can in the time that I have the basic elements of the Christian faith. I suppose that a task like this isn't really made any easier by the fact that true historic Christianity is so often overlaid and encrusted in the minds of most people by such factors as the institutional church and ecclesiastic backgrounds of various sorts, so that most people find it difficult to strip away the encrustment of ecclesiasticism from the bare bones of what Christianity is all about. My concern will be, therefore, to try to get beyond and beneath all this kind of confusion that perhaps the institutional church has been the cause of bringing into the minds of many people, to the basic elements of historic apostolic Christianity. If you were, for example, to ask me whether there is a future for the institutional church in the last part of the 20th century, I would have to say that as it is constituted at the moment, I think that's an open question. But if you were to ask me, is there a future for the Christian faith and the Christian gospel and for historic Christianity? Then my answer would be that the only worthwhile future lies precisely here. Now, I think I ought to say, too, before we get down to the subject of this evening, that it would be unreal of me to pretend that I am embarking on this inquiry into Christianity with you with a spirit of clinical detachment, so that I am able to detach myself altogether from the realities and claims of the Christian faith. I was not, if I may be personal for a moment, I was not brought up as a Christian. Neither was my home background a Christian background, but at the outset of my university career I found myself faced with the claims of Jesus Christ as they were portrayed in the lives of other people, and I committed my life to Jesus Christ then and discovered the whole of my subsequent life completely changed. This is why I am in the ministry today and have the great privilege of having it as my full-time occupation to commend the Christian gospel to other people. I never had any intention of being a minister. My intention was, and I had ratified it by applying to the appropriate faculty, to study medicine. But when I became a Christian and when the power of Jesus Christ began to grip my life, I discovered that he had another purpose for me, and I am here this evening because of that. I think it's not unimportant to say that for the sake of clarity and of honesty. I believe, however, that there is a right approach to this inquiry which it's important that we should take, and there are two things involved which I want to say just a word about. There are two things principally involved, and the first is that I think we need to come to this inquiry with honesty, fundamentally. That is, with an absolutely open mind. Now, it's very often Christians who are encouraged by other people that they have a great need to have an open mind about things. And I think it's immensely important for us all to be absolutely honest in that our minds are open. That is, open both ways. Open to be persuaded that the Christian message is true, and that we are ready to face the facts as they are set before us. It seems to me, too, that if we are going to make this inquiry into the Christian faith together, which I would suggest to you is incumbent upon people like ourselves at some stage in our lives, we must do it not only with honesty but with diligence. That is, we must be ready to give our minds to it and to think with care through the issues that are involved. God is described in the Bible as the God who is the rewarder of them that diligently seek him. And I think we need to give some diligence to this. One of the reasons that very many people have rejected the Christian faith is that they have never really got down to a serious inquiry into it. And it seems to me we need to give ourselves with some diligence to this, and we owe it to ourselves and to our conscience to do so. But actually, I think, again, before we now come to the main theme of this evening, it would be important to say, too, that the center of the Christian message is not that God has made us and then left us to seek him, that he exists and waits for us to find him by some kind of mysterious method of searching out various possibilities as to whether there is a God or whether there isn't a God. The fact is that the essence of the Christian gospel does not say that God has left it to us to seek him. There is another side to this seeking which is infinitely more important. And that is that God has told us it is he who is seeking us. Jesus not only told us, seek and you will find. He described himself in these terms, I am come to seek and to save that which was lost. And perhaps the most important thing about this week is this other side to the phenomenon of seeking, that God himself may be beginning to make it apparent to us that he is seeking us. Well, now the question arises, where must such an inquiry as this begin? Where must a statement of what Christianity is and what Christians believe start? And the answer is that so far as the historic Christian faith is concerned, there is only one place to begin, and that is with the issue that Christianity holds to be central, namely the person and identity of Jesus Christ. Who was Jesus of Nazareth is the fundamental question by which Christianity stands or falls. He is unquestionably Christianity's central figure, and the Christian message not only centers upon him, it rests upon him. And it's who he says he is which is the foundation upon which the entire Christian faith is built. It was Dr. Griffith Thomas of Oxford who said accurately of the Christian faith that Christianity is the only religion in the world which rests for its validity upon the person of its founder. Certainly it's impossible to begin to examine the New Testament without discovering that this is the issue that Jesus himself constantly forced to the forefront of people's thinking. He was not primarily concerned that people should admire him as a great teacher, or that they should be impressed by his acts of kindness, or even by the remarkable things that he was able to do. The fundamental issue with which Jesus was continually confronting people was this question: who do men say that I am? Who do you say that I am? What do you think of Christ? These are the issues that Jesus is continually bringing before people. And not only this, but when people confronted him, they found that this was the question which immediately confronted them. Who then is this, they say? When they begin to discover what he says and what he does, they listen to him, for example, pronouncing a man's sins to be forgiven on one occasion. And immediately the question that arises to them is, who is this that speaks such blasphemy? Now, before we turn to the New Testament evidence for the answer to this question, who is Jesus Christ, there are two matters that I think it's probably important to say a little about. One is the historicity of Christ, and the other is the reliability of the Gospels, which are the records in which we find the words and works of Jesus. First of all, I think it important to say something about the historicity of Jesus of Nazareth, because from time to time one comes across attempts to deny the historical fact of Jesus' existence. The latest one that you may have seen is made by a man called John Allegro, who lectured for some time in Old Testament studies in Manchester University and gained his fame by being widely publicized in the Daily Mail particularly, and then in other daily newspapers. His hypothesis was that the figure of Jesus of Nazareth was a mythical, legendary figure whose reality was only to be found in some shadowy figure cast up by the Dead Sea Scrolls. And this got a great deal of write-up in the popular papers, John Allegro being described as the greatest scourge of Christianity since Pontius Pilate. But it is only recording the facts to say that all the theories that John Allegro propounded have been refuted and repudiated by a galaxy of experts in the very fields from which he was drawing his evidence. And they wrote, these men, some 20 or so of them, to the London Times from almost every university where there was a field of discipline in this study, and their position is summarized in the words of one of them: the doubts, he says, which have been cast on the historical reality of Jesus are unworthy of serious attention. Now, it's impossible this evening to go into all this in detail, but if you are interested, it is possible to find in the writings of pagan historians like Pliny, for example, whose dates are 61 to 114 AD, Tacitus, whose dates are from 55 to around 118 AD, and someone like Suetonius, whose dates are from 69 AD to about 130, where there are clear historical references to the events of Christ's death. and earlier still in the historian Thallus, who writes as early as AD 52 and is quoted by a number of others, there is historical reference to the darkness which fell on the occasion of Jesus' death, which Thallus, contradicted by a later writer who quotes him, suggests was due to an eclipse of the sun. Now you get more detailed references to the life of Jesus and the figures surrounding him, such as Pilate and Annas and Caiaphas and the Herods and so on, in the writings of the Jewish historian Josephus. You will notice that these are all extra-Christian sources, who also tells us of John the Baptist and his preaching and his execution. Now, Otto Benz has committed himself to this statement which summarizes this evidence, and from this subject we will then depart. No serious scholar, he says, would venture to postulate today the non-historicity of Jesus of Nazareth. A word now about the reliability of the Gospels, where obviously we are going to find the basis of all that we are going to say about Jesus. This is the source from which we derive the claims to which I will want to draw your attention that Jesus makes for himself. The question that arises is, are these Gospels reliable documents? Are we able to put credence upon them? It needs to be said, I think, that the reliability of the manuscripts of the New Testament Gospels is unusually well attested and infinitely superior to that of other accepted historians of the same era. For example, Tacitus, who writes in the 2nd century concerning events somewhere around 50 years before his era, is considered a first-rate historical source for this period, despite the fact that the earliest manuscripts of Tacitus's history are something like 1,000 years after Tacitus's time, and we have only something like 20 manuscripts of his work. But that does not deter historians from recognizing that Tacitus is a thoroughly reliable source. The same is true of the Greek historian Thucydides, whose first manuscripts come something like 1,300 years after his time. Now, in the case of the New Testament Gospels, as is recognized and acknowledged, the textual witness is infinitely superior. There are no less than 4,000 Greek manuscripts which have survived, some of them of very primitive date. And there is no fundamental Christian doctrine on which they in any sense disagree. There are minor adjustments that are made from manuscript to manuscript, but the fundamental Christian doctrines and the fundamental sayings of Jesus, they are agreed upon. Now it seems to me that acceptance of the Gospels as a substantially accurate record of the life and teaching of Jesus is as well grounded as any possible historical document of this antiquity could be. And we are coming, therefore, to something which is solid ground when we come to the Gospels. Now, we come to the crucial issue, then, of the identity of Jesus of Nazareth. And what I want to put before you now is what Jesus himself actually claimed about himself. This is the vital issue, as it seems to me, that we need to face ourselves with. Whatever we may think about Christianity, it's true that the vast majority of people will acknowledge that Jesus was at least a great man and a great teacher. This is something which is universally held by everybody who knows even a little about him. But when you come to examine the evidence, and this is where it's so important to come to grips with what Christianity is really all about, when you come to examine the evidence, you discover that his claims for himself are staggeringly greater than the assessment of him that people have. People easily toss off this cozy picture of Jesus as the great moral teacher, or the great leader, or the man who lived such an extraordinary life. But the fact is that it's impossible impossible, as I hope to show you this evening, to hold this and still to face the clear-cut, indisputable things that Jesus actually said about himself. And now I want us to look at some of these things that Jesus says, the claims that he makes. What is it that he actually says about himself? As people are presented with the picture of Jesus Christ, what is it that he says and claims about himself? I can only give you some selected examples because the evidence is so overwhelming, but let me choose some of them. For example, one day, one of Jesus' hearers comes to him with the kind of request that we would find eminently reasonable. He says, "Now we know and are persuaded about other things by exercising our senses, the senses of sight and of touch, for example. And we find it impossible to see and believe in God because we can't exercise these senses. And so they say to Jesus, 'If you will show us the Father, we will be satisfied.'" Now listen, Jesus' answer is, "He who has seen me has seen the Father." Show us God, they say to Jesus, and he says, "To look upon me is to look upon God." In almost the same breath, he speaks to the same group of people and tells them that access to God was restricted to those who would come to him. Now can you see what a shattering claim this is for someone to make? "Only those who come to me," Jesus says, "can find their way to God. No man comes to the Father but by me." Again, one of the unique offices of God, which all the Jews acknowledged to belong only to him, was that he was going to be the judge of men. God, in the whole of Jewish thought, is the only judge of the world. But to these very people, Jesus takes precisely this title of the judge of the world and applies it to himself, declaring that he will preside at the last judgment of the world and that the destinies of men are going to be in his hands. Now, can you imagine the impact, for example, that this would make upon you if I had to get up and say something so ludicrous as this? That there was going to come a day when I would preside at the last judgment of the world and your eternal destiny was going to depend upon your reaction to me. But this is precisely what Jesus says. All judgment, he says, God the Father has put in my hand. He taught them, too, that the same honor that was due to God was due to him, that all men should honor the Son, that is Jesus, even as they honor the Father. He speaks almost casually of his coexistence with God before the beginning of the world. "The glory which I had with you," he says, "before the world began." But perhaps Jesus' most dramatic statement in the midst of his teaching was one that's often passed over. You may not be familiar with the story, but let me explain it to you because it's very important. It occupies an important place in the gospel record of Jesus' life and teaching. The most sacred name of God to the Jew was the name I Am. It goes back into Old Testament times where Moses asks God how he shall tell people who God is. And God says to him, "When you go to them, tell them who I am with these words, 'I am has sent me,' and the name, the self-existent one, the one who needs no others for his existence, is the name that Jesus, that God applies to himself." Now, this is indeed to the Jew, the holy name of God. It's a name, in fact, that no Jew will ever take upon his lips. I remember being in the Hebrew class in Glasgow University with a large number of Jewish people because I was the only Gentile taking the subject. And when we were asked to read along the class, it was very striking to discover the thing, of course, we were reading was the Hebrew scriptures of the Old Testament. And when they came to the holy name of God, they substituted another. And I was immediately concluding these people had made a mistake. The reason was not that they made a mistake, but this name was so holy, they wouldn't take it upon their lips. Now, one day, Jesus is engaged in a discussion with the Jews about Abraham and his importance. And in the midst of it, Jesus says to them, "Before Abraham was, I am." And immediately these people turn and take up stones and they begin to stone Jesus, which is the punishment for blasphemy. Now you'll notice that Jesus is not claiming here antiquity, because that would have required different grammar. That would have been "before Abraham was, I was," which would have been ludicrous for a man to claim anyway. But what he is actually claiming is deity. And these Jews were in no doubt about this. They knew very well this was precisely what Jesus was claiming. And they take up stones and cast him out, stoning him for blasphemy, because he had taken the holy name of God and applied it to himself. He further makes the claim, not only in his teaching, but in his actions, to forgive sins. There was an occasion when a man who was suffering from paralysis was brought to Jesus by his friends one day, and they were hoping that Jesus would cure him. And when he is brought into the place where Jesus is, contrary to their expectation, Jesus speaks words which apply not to the man's illness, but to something infinitely deeper than this, and he says, "Your sins are forgiven you." Now, the people are immediately astonished, for this simple reason, that it's possible for someone to forgive someone else for something that they have done to you. If someone commits some kind of offense against you, it's a perfectly reasonable thing for you to say, "I forgive you." But what Jesus is doing here is saying that everything wrong that this man has done, he forgives him. "I forgive you everything that you've done wrong." Now immediately the people begin to murmur and they say amongst themselves, "Who can forgive sins but God? This is his prerogative. It's not the prerogative of a man to forgive somebody's sins. He can forgive personal wrongdoing, but not general guilt. This is something no man can lift," as we all of us have recognized. But Jesus turns to this man and professes to be able to forgive his sins. Now, you will notice here that I'm not asking you to believe or to accept the miraculous. That's another question altogether with which we're not dealing at the moment. But Jesus turns to this man and says to the crowd, "Which is easier?" He says, "There are two things that only God can do. One is to forgive sins, the other is to say to this man in his condition, 'Rise up and walk.'" Now the reason that Jesus says to the man, "Rise up and walk," is quite clear. He says, "In order that you may know that I have power to forgive sins," he turns to the man who is lame and says, "Get up and walk." Now Jesus' point is, you see, that just as only God can forgive sins, only God can say to this man, "Rise up and walk." If he can do the one, he is able to do the other. And if he is demonstrated to be God by the one, he is demonstrated therefore to be God in the other case too. And his purpose, whatever you may think I say again of the miraculous, Jesus' purpose was to claim that he was able as God to forgive sins. Now again, before the end of his earthly life, a man comes to Jesus and bows before him after a period of skepticism and says to him, and there is nobody else that he's directing it to, "My Lord and my God." He describes Jesus as God. Now Jesus does not rebuke the man, rather he blesses him and says that this man has come to discover at last the truth. Now, sometime later in the New Testament, the greatest Christian of New Testament days and perhaps of all time, Paul of Tarsus, has somebody comes to him with almost the same language. People bow down before him when they see something that he has done, and they are deeply impressed by him, and they're rather primitive people, and they come and they bow down before Saul and before Barnabas, his companion. And immediately, Paul, because he recognizes the folly of this kind of thing with a mere man, he turns to them and he says, "Cut it out." He says, "You get up off your knees. You have no business using that language to me. I am just a man like other men, and a sinner like other sinners." He says, "You get up." But Jesus never says this. He says the man has come to the truth and believed it when he describes him as my Lord and my God. Now let me summarize in brief. You will notice the things that Jesus claims. He claims that to see him is to see God. To know him is to know God. To honor and worship him is to honor and worship God. He takes the holy name of God and applies it to himself. He claims to be able to forgive sins which only God can do. And he forecasts that he is going to be the one who will judge the world. Now, such claims as these bring us to but one conclusion. And that is the conclusion which is the only possible one in reading the gospel record of the life and teaching of Jesus. And it is whatever other people may think of him, and whatever we may think of him, the personal conviction of Jesus was that he was God in his person and in his nature. And these claims in themselves, while they establish absolutely nothing, do logically drive us, I would suggest to you, to a position where this picture of Jesus as merely a great moral teacher or a good man or something of the kind completely disintegrates. The late professor of medieval English in Cambridge summed it up like this, and let me quote these words to you. "I am trying here to prevent," he says, "anyone from saying the really foolish thing that people often say about Christ. I'm ready to accept Jesus, they say, as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God." Now that is the one thing we cannot do. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on a level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil in hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or he is a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God, but let us not come with any of this patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. Now that is precisely the position. And you'll see that the dilemma that this leaves us with is really, if there is such a word, a trilemma. For there are three possible positions to take up in reaction to these claims of Jesus. The claims that he makes may be false, if you can think this through with me. They may be false in one of two ways. Either Jesus is sincere but deluded, or he is a deliberate impostor. In other words, either he was wrong and knew he was wrong, or he was wrong and was blissfully unaware of it. And the third alternative is that he is precisely who he claimed to be. Now we need, before we come to a conclusion, to look at each of these briefly. The first is that Jesus is sincere but deluded. Which kind of megalomania is not unknown. But the fact is that hardly any of these men deceive anyone except themselves.
Their delusion is so obvious. Their imbalance is something that's apparent to normal people. But the crucial thing about Jesus is that the skill and depth of his teaching only argues for a remarkable and uncommon kind of mental balance, so that when people have inquired into it, they come away saying, "Oh, that we could be as sane as he is, as balanced as he is, as integrated as he is in his thinking and in his character." Certainly no unbiased reader of the New Testament would gain the impression of silliness or imbalance about Jesus. Again, if I may quote Professor Lewis to you, the discrepancy, he writes, between the depth and sanity, and let me add the shrewdness of his moral teaching, and the rampant megalomania which must lie behind his theological teaching, unless he is indeed God, has never been satisfactorily got over. But there is something more. I would suggest to you that it is quite extraordinary, to the point of being incredible, that someone with this kind of megalomania about himself, this grand delusion that he was God — and I say again, this grand delusion is not uncommon — but is it not incredible that someone with this kind of delusion should be ruled by words like these: "The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give away his life as a ransom for many. I do not seek my own glory." This is the whole character of Jesus' life, you see. On the one hand, he is so utterly self-centered in all his teaching. He summons people to himself. It is he who is the whole center and content of the message that he has to preach. And yet, on the other hand, he is utterly selfless in his behavior. One day the disciples discover this who are around him, when he turns and lays aside his outer garment and puts a towel around him and takes the most menial place in the company of those who are there and washes the feet of those who have come in from the dusty roads, a task that only the lowest servant would take, and that obviously even his disciples were shirking. But Jesus comes, on the one hand, with this self-centered teaching, and yet on the other, with this self-effacing and selfless life. Nor was this simply an occasional achievement in his behavior, this self-sacrifice, as it is for us. It is of the essence of it. From beginning to end, he is giving himself away in the service of others, so that others write of him, "Christ pleased not himself. He made himself of no reputation." Now it is this humble, lowly Jesus that everybody recognizes as the genuine picture of the Jesus of the Gospels. And can you imagine someone with megalomaniac tendencies with this kind of character? Well, let's look at the second possibility. That is, that he was deceiving other people intentionally. Now you will notice what it involves. He was recognizing, although not disclosing, that what he said was false. He was misleading and deceiving people, which of course makes Jesus a wicked impostor. But the problem here is that it's impossible to find even the semblance of hypocrisy and pretense in him. And even those who are enemies of the Christian faith recognize the perfection of the character of Jesus. You look at the verdict that his friends, who are closest to him and knew him best of all, give. They see him continually over a period of 3 years, in conditions of tiredness and testing, and besieged by crowds, and often doubtless driven to distraction. But Peter, one of those who was closest to him, says of him, in well-attested New Testament words, he committed no sin, and no guile was found on his lips. John, another who was closest to him, says of ordinary humans, if we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves. But of Jesus, he says, in him there was no sin. The enemies of Jesus found it equally impossible to get some kind of inconsistency in his character when he turns upon them after they have been finding fault with someone and says, which of you can convict me of sin? They all turn away, unable to find some crack in his moral character. Now you think of my standing before people who knew me, or your standing before people who knew you, and being able to challenge them with this. The thing is impossible. It doesn't take long for people to discover inconsistencies in us. But in Jesus, they found it impossible. But the significant thing, of perhaps most significant of all, is that when Jesus is assessing his own moral character, he says quite casually, I always do what is pleasing to God. He had a complete absence of any sense of moral discontent, which is such a radical feature of the life of every honest man. And this puts him, of course, in a unique class, unique in the midst even of the greatest people, the greatest religious figures of all time. Because the universal experience of all good men is that the nearer they come to God, the more aware they are of their own failing and of their own sin. You find this coming out in hymns of various sorts which say things like this, they who fain would serve thee best are conscious most of wrong within. And this is true. But for Jesus it was not true. His character was a character that was unsullied by sin. And again, I would suggest to you that believing Jesus to be a crooked impostor is so inconsistent with the evidence as to be incredible. This is the position with which we are confronted when we come to the question, who is Jesus of Nazareth? And I would suggest to you that the only answer, which is a reasonable answer, is that he is indeed who he claimed to be, in his person and in his nature, God. But when you do face this question, and I suggest to you that it is the fundamental question from which we may not allow ourselves to be diverted until we have come to some answer about this, we discover that it is not a mere academic question. People sometimes think, you see, that they can sit down and discuss the Christian faith in the same way that they might discuss a scientific hypothesis. But the fact is that God does not prove his existence by a set of logical propositions. He reveals himself rather in a living person. And the real thrust of this question, once you begin to apply it to yourself, and seriously and honestly to set about answering it, the real thrust of it is this, that you can't respond to a living person the way you do to a set of logical propositions. It is an infinitely deeper thing to respond to a living person. And the claim of Jesus is that the greatest need of men is for himself. True life, he says, is only to be found in me. He has come from God in order that he might begin to tell us what life is all about. He has come from God to deal with the most intractable problems of human guilt and of the meaning of human life. And he has come in order that he might take us and show us the God who made us for himself. Now this is what is involved in coming face to face with the Jesus of historic Christianity. Further, the essence of sin, if Jesus is who he declares to be, himself to be, the essence of sin will not be such external things as murder and adultery and so on. They will be and are, according to Jesus, keeping him from his rightful place in our lives as God and Savior. For he came not simply to convince men of his identity as God, but to offer himself to them. He summoned men to come to him that they might receive from him the life and the forgiveness that he had to bring to them. And the great condemnation that Jesus pronounced upon men was, "You will not come to me that you might have life." So that you see, this question is something of a boomerang question. It rebounds upon us. And we discover that there is infinitely more in it when we have come to the conclusion that Jesus is who he said he was. Then we find that the claims that he makes upon us become living and real and universal claims upon our lives. So I'd suggest to you that the vital question that we need to ask about Christianity is not the question that many people ask about the Christian faith and about other religions. Namely, is it satisfying? Is it worthwhile? Is it helpful? The vital question to ask about Christianity is it true? That's what matters. Is it true? And if you have set about a careful inquiry into the whole issue of whether or not it is true, and find that it is, and that Jesus Christ is, or that the most obvious answer to the question is that he is who he declares himself to be, then you discover that he invites us to come to him as Thomas, whom I quoted earlier, came to him saying, "You are my Lord and my God, and my greatest folly has been to hold back my life from you and to ignore you in life heretofore, because all the deepest longings in my heart and life I now find are for you, and the things you say about yourself and about me, I now come to commit myself to and ask you to be my God and my Lord and my Savior." This is, it seems to me, is the crucial issue. And I am certain that once people like ourselves come face to face with questions of this kind and begin to sift the evidence thoroughly, there is no end to what such an inquiry can do in our lives. Tomorrow evening, I hope we may go on to try to discover what it is that the Christian faith has to say about ourselves in relation to Jesus of Nazareth.